coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. Can you believe we are on issue 229? Not 239, like my note says, 229.
Yeah, not 200, and we didn't just finish 237 through 230, or 235 through 237, like your misnumbered files.
I got off by, you know why? I can tell you why. It's because that started about the time that I started watching Legion, and I couldn't, my ability to focus and transmit thought completely, it left me when I was trying to figure out what that show is.
Is it like the fifth or sixth issue of Watchmen? Yeah, I figured out a way to get that in there now.
I'm sure it's going to come back up later. Matter of fact, I know it's going to come back up later, but yeah.
One worker reading everything through Dr. Manhattan's point of view.
Right.
And then it takes you about a week to stop shaking.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was.
Back in the 80s when I'm reading, I'm like, I'm driving to the university. I'm at the university. No, fuck this.
I don't need to narrate everything. It's not happening all at once. I'm actually, I exist in a linear time field.
Yeah,
I get
surprised by what happens when I get there.
Right. I don't know before and after and during what's happening. Speaking of knowing before and after during what's happening, tonight we have a show which we have been long wanting to do. We're going to cover a couple of the comic TV shows that we haven't covered. You know, we've covered pretty extensively the Netflix shows. You know, we do movies whenever we get the opportunity.
During Daredevils, we couldn't shut up.
But. Oh, my God. And we won't be able to again, by the way, when the rest of that stuff. I did see, not to go too far afield immediately, but my new favorite thing in the world is there's a licensing convention in like Las Vegas, and I've been following it very closely, and there's some really awesome movie accurate or TV show accurate, I should say, Defenders accurate Marvel Select figures coming, like a Daredevil Marvel Select figure that looks, and this isn't the Legends, this is like the Select, a little bit bigger, a little bit more premium format figures that look just smashing. So I can't wait for that, but we digress. These are shows that we've been wanting to cover, we haven't covered. Cole found a way to make us, to force us to do it, because I just can't, half of this thing I can't wrap my brain around, so I'm really curious to see how this is going to play out. So
yeah, this was an interesting thing because there was, sometimes we'll take a concept that at first blush they seem like a really, like we'd be barely able to squeeze an hour out of them, and then we're all of a sudden it becomes an arc.
right.
And then the other side of it is this one where the temptation was very strong to do entire episodes on each of these two shows, or even somehow find a way to make an arc out of all of these components, you know, these two shows plus others, if we could find that. And the thing about it is that the reality is that it seemed more logical to go the opposite direction in this case. And this is to take a couple of complex subjects and force ourselves to really look at them not so much in a rapid fire way, but be as concise as possible about our approach to them, because I think each of them, they don't need to be padded out, and I think we can find that happy medium, we can find that common ground where it'll work this way.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to spend half of this show talking about, and I'm going to bury the lead, because people need to know now if they need to stop listening and go watch them, because as always,
that's so true.
Super spoiler heavy. So we're going to talk about Legion and Preacher tonight. Legion made my eyes bleed.
Not only are we going to go ahead and get that out in advance, if you haven't seen one or both, this is a good opportunity before you tune us out until you've seen them. to point out that you need to see both.
You really, really do.
Owe it to yourself, and then you can come back and nod appreciatively as you see how right we were.
Right, right. We haven't steered you wrong yet, so stay with us on this. So, yeah, we're going to start with Legion. We're going to lead into Preacher, but, you know, the one thing I wanted to say about these two shows as sort of a as halves of a whole is we have all these shows that are bombastic, these regularly appearing shows, the Netflix shows, the CW shows, your Arrow Universe, your Flash, your Supergirl, your upcoming Krypton TV shows. You have your Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with crazy ghost writers and you know, I'm sorry, I almost said mutants, Inhumans, and the Darkhold, and LMDs, and all this stuff. And then you get shows like this, which while Legion had mutants in it, while Preacher has, you know, super crazy angelic vampire like weird supernatural shit happening, these shows are a lot more intimate, and the story revolves around the intimacy of the characters a lot more than some of the other shows do. So they pair very well together in that sense. They're like a nice tilapia and white wine, if you will.
Absolutely. This is going to be like a two-course sampling, like a chef's table kind of thing, because we're going to give you two very psychologically driven and psychologically mess you up kind of shows.
Yeah.
And those who have seen them already are going to be, I mean, literally, they should come with some sort of hotline.
So we're going to start with Legion, I think is a good place to start with this. I want to ask this question of Cole. What the hell is it about? I don't know. I watched all of it. I am a fairly intelligent human being. I have read comics from, you know, I've read X-Men from Claremont on. I have read Legion comics. What did I watch? I want to, what can you help me out here?
I think what you watched is literally it's lightning in a bottle in a sense, in that it is someone has managed to bottle the unfathomable. This is the untouched regions of the brain that fill in the blank percentage we don't use, as far as you know, that makes compelling yet ridiculous science fiction.
Yes, yes.
When you get right down to it, because, you know, a lot of the brain isn't used to stave off psychic powers or anything like that.
Maybe yours isn't. Speak for yourself. Yeah. Get a mouse in your pocket.
That's right. Chapstick. Well, that sounds like that's a whole different kind of psychological. But what Legion does is, it more so than any other show I've ever seen, puts you in the mind of its protagonist to the point where you're suffering the same doubts,
yeah,
the same misgivings, and the same this is like if your day started where you woke up in Inception and you were pretty well convinced that you'd already been there.
Right.
And that, like, every time you woke up from a dream state, you were forced to live in this state that you didn't believe near as much as that dream state where you have weird things like, you know, alligators down in the creek where you used to hang out and play as a kid. For some reason, the alligators are a prevailing recurring theme since childhood, with absolutely no catalyst. So, you know, this puts you into a very surreal place, and I think the core concept is you're not meant to really know to be able to work out reality, even when it's ultimately provided.
Yeah, the show does such a brilliant job of taking you within the mind of the protagonist, right? With taking you within his mind, developing a world there, pulling you out of that world into another world that could very well be still within his mind. That you, by the end of the show, when they're telling you pretty much point blank, no, this is real life. You're witnessing real life. You're
you
like, no, I'm not.
The end of the tunnel. Yeah, you don't know what to believe because nothing. And even the real world becomes such a surreal panoply that you can't buy into that at full.
Right. They paint this beautiful picture of the world that you're in to the point of that it's so surreal and so exo interesting that you don't believe that it's the real world even at the end, because of the colors they use, because of the music. And that's another thing about both shows I want to touch on, and we'll post I found both the soundtracks on Spotify, so I have Spotify links for this, is they use music in both of these shows so brilliantly.
Oh yes.
Like the only other one I can think of that is parallel to this is Luke Cage and their use of music, which they actually folded into the storyline. But this, the music that they use to paint the picture along with the visuals is perfect. So they take you to a place that you don't know. Like you said, they take you into the mind of the protagonist. And my question for you, Cole, is do they ever take you out? Because I don't know if they do.
Yeah, I think there are all these little moments where you get some glimpses of the outside world, but they're very often focused through the lens of that uncertainty. And it's further exacerbated by, like you say, the color scheme, the set design. I mean, nothing is – oddly enough, the super secret top security headquarters of the antagonist becomes – both the least and most realistic locale that you visit, because all of the other locales are so ridiculously over the top that they become almost inexplicable. You're not really certain precisely what things were supposed to be before. A good example is the insane asylum.
Yes.
Because it's
the clock, they call it the clockwork.
Yeah, the clockwork. Because it's sort of a combination of the sets of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the high school in Twin Peaks.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And that's something I wanted to talk about is, and we talked about this when the show was on, is it's this beautiful, it's a superhero show by way of a beautiful homage to like David Lynch and Stanley Kubrick. It somehow manages to tie all these disparate themes of the 70s together in real Artur experimental movie making and camera work and just weird shit that makes it all work. I don't want to know.
Oh, yes. And there's a wonderful juxtaposition in the set design and the production design in general that mashes beautifully all of these different time periods. It becomes almost a timeless tale, and perhaps therein lies the only indication of where does reality begin. But even within the context of reality, there is this surreality. Is that a term?
We're coining it right now.
Yeah, God knows we've coined terms like molar roaming something.
Oh, no, God, it's back. it's back. Damn it.
But, you know, there's so many aspects of, like, the costuming and the set designs that draw together. It's like going into I don't know if you've had this experience, you're going to feel the little hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and that's when you're invited to the home of a friend of a friend of a friend, and it's a house that was built in 1947, remodeled in 1968, and has, you know, appliances from 2009 and artifacts from, you know, every century therein, and you know, there's just everything is a jumble of the modern and the vintage. You have the flat screen television above the old turntable console from the 60s, and it just, you're not really sure how you, if you've stepped into some sort of juxtaposition museum that. So there's a lot of anachronisms running rampant through there, yet they seem to all have this perfect flow. And then of course at the what do they call those that befriend him,
I don't remember. Their
weird ass headquarters where, you know, the you've got the one their research scientist who is like has a basically an MRI from that, you know, probably bought at a hospital clearance sale from about 10 years ago when they upgraded to the new model that was sold to them on the assurance that you get 20 people through here, it practically pays for itself. And they're running it off of some sort of like steampunk amalgam of you know, electronics that are partly Radio Shack from the last tail end of the last century through modern components. So it's that. It's the bizarre sort of piece of a natural history museum that's taken up some serious real estate there.
So this is the part that's really interesting to me, right, if I'm breaking the show down, is when we start looking at the flashbacks, and if you know the story of Legion, really all you need to know going – if you don't know anything going in, great. If you're a comic book fan or you want to know the kind of background in the comics, it's pretty simple. I mean, it gets into the hairy middle of things, as all comic book characters do, with continuity and weird stuff that happens. But, you know, the idea is that this kid was born in part and parcel by the seed of Professor X and is an Omega level mutant, which means he is the upper echelon of power sets of mutants. The way that it manifests itself is in the sense that he has multiple personality disorder in the comics. In the show, I believe he had dissociative identity disorder, which is the more modern terminology.
Yes, exactly.
And each of those identities has a power. Now, what Cole and I have often discussed, and what's been discussed in the comics, is does each of those identities have a power because the mind couldn't control all of the powers it was given, or which came first? Was it chicken or egg? Was it the powers or the identities? Right? Which one of those was the originator?
Yes. Is it the mind's fracturing of the powers because it perhaps the mind is so powerful that it recognizes its own danger, and therefore it's a self-limiter?
Right.
Or did the personalities manifest around the individual powers and ultimately was it a cause and effect?
Correct. But if you start looking at the point at which he starts developing powers as a child, because that's when we start seeing things happen if you watch the flashbacks in the show. If it was me, right, and I was that age and I started developing powers and I locked myself in my own mind, the way that an MRI machine would work, if I was imagining it, is exactly the way that the MRI machine would work in that.
Yes, exactly.
If I had a weird ass steampunk cappuccino machine that had an iPad strapped to it that sang me songs and told me stories in the voice of my supposedly deceased husband, that's the way it would look. So is this just in his manifest, in his imagination, the way things are supposed to work? Or is this...
Oh, is that why we have the disconnect between the modern and the...
Yes.
The sort of Victorian...
Right,
approached.
weird, you know, blimp type things, and you know, but then you also have badass, you know, special forces guys coming in. Are the two worlds melded in the way that we're seeing things out of his point of view? You know, that's,
and it can ultimately beg
God,
the question: does this become a Red King syndrome?
God damn it, dude! I don't know.
Do you want to know? I mean, what if the big reveal is that everything happened in his head?
I would love it. I would friggin' love it if they gave
us. And at the end, they like spend the last, they just blow their wad on hiring Patrick Stewart to come in and appear at the very end of the series and just, you know, like take the Cerebro helmet off and just say, this one seriously fucked up. Yeah, this has all just been what he's been watching.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Charlie's been locked up with him. You know, they just like bring the whole gang in for Ron, and they're like.
That would be awesome. If that was the case, I would absolutely love it. I would have no problems with that.
absolutely none of it was real. It was absolutely everything, this world that he'd created within himself, that Xavier tries to delve into and then finds himself just barely able to swim back to the surface.
That would be perfect. I would absolutely love it. So, you know, what is, if you were selling this show to people, what is the one thing that you would use to sell this show? If I wasn't going to watch it and you were like, you really need to watch it, and I said, all right, why do I need to watch it? What is your elevator speech for why I should watch this show?
Like if I'm at a convention and I'm talking about, well, hey, you know, have you seen the Legion?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, I haven't seen Legion. Why do you insist on putting
in front of everything? God damn it, Cole.
Strange person. I think that my selling point for this is, it's kind of hard to sell considering the topic tonight, but you are never going to find, you cannot compare this to anything else.
Yes.
If you want to watch something wildly original and different that will take you out, it puts you in a comfortable place, a familiar place, but takes you so far away from that. It's like going on safari with grandma. No matter how far into the bush you go, they've taken the whole kitchen with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you get back from, like, you know, shooting at rhinos and looking at giraffes and elephants narrowly escaping a leopard attack, there's like, everything, you know, that cake that nobody else can quite get right, because that's there and you know it's there, and there's a bit of comfort and home in this strange surroundings, and it almost becomes a virtual bucket list of thing. It's like, you know, this was that adventure I wanted to have without getting off my ass.
I mean, it's one of those things where, and to kind of piggyback on what you just said, it's if you want to show if you like Twin Peaks, right?
The Twin Peaks, yes.
If you like the Twin Peaks, it's gonna start happening to me too, and it's gonna
be like, damn you! It'd be like Jerry Seinfeld, Newman.
You know, if you like that idea, that David Lynchian idea, that you're that lost highway where there's no resolution and you're left to kind of formulate your own concept of what's real and what isn't within, you know, there's something to be said for The Flash. You start, you got a bad guy, you got a storyline, you fight the bad guy, you win the day, there's some conflict in there, you know, and you're going to resolve it next season. There's something to be said for that. But as much as there's something to be said for that, there's a lot to be said for this, where you leave with more questions than you had coming in. And I love that. And to piggyback off of that idea, my favorite thing, and I was talking to Cole about this, doing research for this, and just in general, because I would go out looking for answers. Like, I'd watch an episode, and I'd be like, what the hell? And I would go out and hit the internet and try to find some ideas as to what I just watched. Watching comic internet, including myself, try to shoehorn what they just saw into the comic book universe is hilarious to me. Anything that they can pick up on, any scent that the Basset Hound can get, you know, it's almost like Dukes of Hazzard, where you know that dog's going to take you under a bridge where there's a hot dog. It's not real, and you're not going after the Dukes. You're going to find the hot dog vendor. It's like, well, you know, because the worst one I saw, and I was talking to you about this, is the Eye. The guy,
oh, yes.
The Eye, they were saying, well, you know, the Eye's experiments on mutants really is resembles Mr. Sinister. And I'm like, no, it doesn't, you bunch of assholes. It does not. Stop trying to make this make sense to you.
That both of them were either directly, or in the case of the Eye, largely indirectly involved, the only common thread, which becomes incredibly tenuous. On one side, it is just a little piece of thread that went astray off of the spool.
Right.
And on the other side, in the case of Mr. Sinister, it's an entire garment.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, no.
You can't go and find a piece of thread on the ground and say, wow, seersucker. No, it's not. It's a piece of damn thread. You don't know what it might have been.
Yeah, that's going whole cloth from cheesecloth.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't work. Does it work?
The two are, yes, somehow tenuously attached by virtue of being part of a shared reality, but...
I mean, it is the equivalent of a floating boat city to the comic book, where, you know, you get no state, you have a general idea of what the city is supposed to look like, but you absolutely have no stable footing. You feel like you're going to fall over all the time. And at the other side, you can see Professor X and Legion and the Shadow King, which, by the way, that Shadow King reveal was amazing.
Oh, that was brilliance.
That was that.
Because it took something that simultaneously took you out of the universe you'd been immersed in up to that point.
Right.
Put you in the universe you thought you were supposed to be in some way anyway, that left apparently some grasping so much at straws or threads that they were finding Rogue and...
Oh, yes.
Sinister.
Freaking
and
Rogue.
X-Factor. They were trying to find... Oh, and Mojo.
Well,
and I will admit that when they first revealed the devil with the yellow eyes, the first thing that popped in my head as a casual fan of these periods in, you know, I stopped X-Men long before some of this came down, but I'm aware of it. I'm familiar enough with it that my first impression was this devil with the yellow eyes is one of two people or one of two entities from the X-Men mythos. That's either going to be Mojo, which was initially where I was headed with it. And then as time went on, thinking, okay, no, my second choice was probably close to the mark and was dead on, was the Shadow King.
Right, right. And I had no idea. Like,
because
that was
both of them have a face shaped like Humpty Dumpty.
Well, and if you look like, you know, Amal Farouk, what he looks like in the comic when he's not the Shadow King, right? When he's sort of his usual...
When he's at a tropical restaurant.
Right, when he's...
Dennis Nedry cosplay with
Damn it! I was gonna say Newmaning it up on Jurassic Park, but that's good. Yes.
Chelsea Xavier, we got Xavier here.
Nobody cares. Look, nobody cares.
Why? Because it's all in our heads.
When the reveal is that the Shadow King jumps into Jermaine Clement's brain, and Jermaine Clement. Dan Stevens is an amazing actor. If you haven't seen him in this, he's in this. He follows this with...
I don't know what the hell he was, but I want him in everything now.
Well, he followed this with playing the Beast in the Beauty and the Beast live-action movie. So, I mean, the guy has chops, and he is very, very good. He's a good actor. This show has a great, phenomenal cast. The cast of this show is out of the park. But Jermaine Clement, in anything that he's in, I back 110%. I love him as a comedic actor, as a semi-serious actor. You know, he can do just about anything. But his portrayal of Oliver Byrd, whether it's locked up in Dan Stevens, you know, in Heller's mind, or whether it's, you know, in real life, or whether you're seeing a manifestation of his powers as we saw in Later, which Cole and I immediately jumped all over because it was perfect. It was the music was absolutely...
Oh, my God. The scene where he's essentially allowed to finally exercise his abilities, as mm-hmm. it were. And the overlay of the music and to actually the interplay between it becomes this beautiful psychological pantomime that you just cry that it gets interrupted because it's such a beautiful, brilliantly blocked scene. And the music is in perfect sync with not only the action but the feel of that moment. It belongs there. And I think that's true of all of the music choices that they make. The director of that aspect very much taking cues from modern cinema.
Yeah.
It felt a lot in many ways. I mean, you know, the first instinct is to go to, as Andy and I talked about earlier, I said, you know, it felt a lot like what got me hooked on Guardians of the Galaxy when I wasn't giving a damn.
Yeah.
Before it came out, and then it delivered beyond any expectation. But because that music was a hook, and their advertising was brilliant. But it goes even beyond that. It becomes almost Scorsese with Goodfellas.
Yeah, you're underscoring
the feel of the moment with pop culture music.
And Casino, I mean,
Who the hell, envisions using the long-ass instrumental that borders on being like a lyric-free American Pie from Layla to show a bunch of dead mobsters?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And oh man, I can't begin to much like Twin Peaks, much like there are many there are a few shows in that ilk where I would love to sit here and be able to tell you this is what this show is about and this is why you're going to love it. I can't do that with this show. What I can do though is say you're not going to know what this show is about and you're going to love it.
Absolutely. It will take you on a journey, a very unexpected, very intimate journey into the mind and beyond. It's almost like if Inception made more sense.
Yeah.
I just have to keep going with that from Rick and Morty. What? Inception made sense? I think invoking Twin Peaks is rather apropos because earlier I was going to remark all that was lacking was basically David Lynch eating a donut for one full minute.
Well, the moment I realized that this was going to be...
Or the guy from Riverdale eating a hamburger for one full minute, I'm told.
When I noticed and I realized that this was going to be Lynchian in scope and sound, right? And by sound, I mean like is it sound? Can you fly or sail this ship? is when they were in the clockwork and periodically, like you said, there was a large portion that was it looked like it was lifted straight out of the Smithsonian and dropped into wherever this was. But there was there's a wall in the back of their kind of wreck area that was done up to be a forest scene. And there was a guy. There's a guy that stands against the wall in like a moss gunny suit.
Oh, that's right.
And he's just there. Periodically, he's just there. About once every two episodes, he's just standing against the wall. Never says anything. Never does a damn thing. And I'm like, what the hell is happening right now? I'm like, I love it. I don't know, but I love it. So yeah.
Yeah, you get the impression he's the guy that's like Danny DeVito in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He doesn't actually have to be there. He's not court mandated or anything.
Right. He just comes in the morning.
They just can't get rid of his ass.
He just comes in the morning and then leaves. And
right, goes home, has some lunch, comes back. That's his shtick. You know, that's his day right there.
That's right. So do you have any final thoughts on this show before we move into Preacher, because it's getting to be that point?
I look at this show as being sort of the Odyssey of the brain.
Okay.
Because you have this character who is literally forced to live within his own mind by virtue of the Shadow King, by virtue of, being drugged and convinced that he's psychotic, by virtue of being forced to confront living in his own mind through Ptolemy and the others, when they're mapping out his brain and trying to figure him out. And ultimately, I think the biggest rewards are the wonderful little twists where something that's always been there, you get these little reveals. Or the scene when he's running through when David's bringing the assault.
Yes.
To the headquarters of his enemies.
Oh.
And you get the reveal to his companions that there's something there. But, I mean, good night. That's what you get into this for, is that level of just raw illustration of the power.
Well, when you see Aubrey Plaza, who played the kind of, I guess we can call that character, we get the impression that she's been with Heller all along, for years.
Yeah.
But when you get the idea that she's the kind of proto Shadow King, right? Yeah. It, for him before the big reveal that he then takes on her mannerisms when he's leading that assault, because you've seen her mannerisms every episode leading up to that.
And he, exactly. Does like the little twists of the head and the, mm-hmm. The shrugs of the shoulder.
The
and
little sachets. Yeah. It's such a huge reveal that you literally are taken aback. You're put back on your heels when that realization occurs. Like,
and also you're kind of given one of the things that occurred to me, and I don't know that everybody caught this because it took a lot of just sort of running this through my head over and over again, which is dangerous, is the manifestations of Farouk are age with the character.
Yes.
David's earliest manifestations are the Angry Little Boy book.
Right.
And the visions of the angry boy. Then as he moves into adolescence, he's given this sort of tomboy girlfriend.
Yeah.
And as he moves into his young adulthood and turning to drugs, and, you know, she evolves with him.
Right.
And so you then that begins to call into question, is there yet another incarnation that we aren't aware of yet?
Yeah, because as he is into full adulthood, you start getting the kind of, like you said, the Mojo-esque or, you know, doughy, melted candle physique, monster man that starts hovering around the edges. So, yeah.
And each one of them is a control mechanism on Farouk's part to keep him down.
Yes, exactly. And there are a lot of reveals that we don't want to spoil everything, so there are a lot of reveals that we're not going to give you that you need to watch to get. So many cool little things.
And if you
like
have
you
watched it, how the freaking cool was the reveal on the eye?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because then all of a sudden, that was one of those things where it was just such a subtle thing where you suddenly realize, holy crap, I understand now everything and how freakish it must have been, like when Sid switches bodies.
Yeah, for sure.
Because then you suddenly realize, holy crap, they would have been there, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happened was broadcast back home.
Yep, yeah.
Which didn't know what was going on yet. So that, again, I can't say enough good about it. It's a very much a thinking man's kind of show.
Right.
So,
moving from Legion to Preacher, where if Legion is the Odyssey of the mind, Preacher is more the Odyssey of the soul. If Legion is your Cronenberg Lynch, Preacher is more your Coen Brothers.
Very much so.
Coen Brothers, who directed Raising Arizona? Who directed? Was that the Coen Brothers? That wasn't the Coen Brothers.
Yes, it was, because it is literally like, if you take some of their earliest stuff, it's almost like Blood Simple meets...
Yes.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, no, it's...
It is literally taking both of those, and it has I'm trying to put my finger on where else what other vibes I'm getting from this, because in a way it's almost a Burton-esque...
It has moments.
You get.
It has moments of Burton-esque. You're
there,
right.
There are moments that it so doesn't take itself seriously that you're almost, for the briefest moment, you're removed from the entire story, yet somehow drawn right back in, and it gets away with it in a way that like only Burton can.
So what we have with Preacher is this story of a small-town preacher basically changed his ways to take up his daddy's line of work in Annville, Texas, which is out. I would say, where would you say Annville is? I think they've made comment to Lubbock, so it's got to be out in the Midlands, right?
Yeah, I got that sort of very I don't know. I guess maybe East Texas sort of feel.
Okay.
Or either deep East or deep West Texas.
Right.
Perhaps more of a West Texas feel, because there's still greater in either direction you go. You get into the deep East or the deep West, but the deep East is more piney, and the deep West is more prairie land.
Scrubby. Yeah. But
scrubby cattle land. Good place to raise a lot of cattle.
But the so it really is a show about what about divinity and what makes a human being. And God, it's so good. It's so good, guys. Like I read Preacher. Preacher was my first, I'm going to say Preacher was my first adult comic. Let's say Vertigo, real kind of modern adult comic, you know, like whoa, I can't believe they're getting away with this shit in a comic book kind of comic. When I was just starting to read comics, and to see the show come to fruition and come to life, especially with Seth Rogen as one of the producers and writers, it definitely plays that way. But it's interesting what they've done, because if you've read the comic, and I'm sure a lot of you have, they took the first, They really stretched out what the comic was, because in the show you get the town of Anvil for the first whole season, and the comings and goings and the people, and they're really getting invested in this town. Whereas in the comic, they slash and burn Anvil in the first issue, and everything that happens, it's done. So Cole, what is this show about to you, and why should people watch this show? Because I could talk about this show and the differences in the comics for the next 3 hours, probably. But because yeah,
I came into this with an awareness of the comic.
Okay.
I was aware of, I think I even knew the character names, because, you know, DC directed figures of Cassidy, Tulip, and Jesse Custer.
Cassidy's one of my favorite characters in any comic book of all time. And either iteration, whether it's the comic or the show, remains the same. Just brilliant. Just brilliantly executed.
Oh, God, and the actor portraying him is just perfect. Dead on. You know, I'm trying not to catch notes in American Gods with the Leprechaun, because it's hard not to draw comparisons between the two. But Preacher is, I think, like you said, it's about faith, but it's also about the psychology of faith and the psychology of man. You know, we like to imagine that that faith is the thing that elevates us, you know, in a very Elizabethan sort of attitude about, you know, man's dominion over all of God's creatures. We like to imagine that, you know, faith is unique to man, and therefore man is above all other animals. He is the highest form of animal. Yet here you have perhaps one of the worst types of people in the world, who then decides to redeem himself and become a man of the cloth like his father. Yet you are revealed a very bizarre youth and history that obviously led him away from the church for so very long. And you pit him against the most godless of, you know, the psychotic kind of boss hog who runs the town.
Well, what's funny, before you start talking about Odin, is in the comic, Odin doesn't show up until about 3/4 of the way through the actual comic book run, in a whole different town of Salvation. That whole storyline happens not in Anvil. But in order to flesh out the idea of the story in Anvil and give you kind of a character study on the man that Jesse Custer is, they took that and dropped it into the first arc.
Interesting.
Yeah, so go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I know we both love this.
Oh, no, quite right. That's good backstory. But yeah, but ultimately what you have is this sort of flawed character trying to do the good. And you know, literally he's going out of his way. He's just, you know, there's not a lot of lip service to this. He's determined to try to not only redeem himself and to redeem his, or, you know, return to the faith, but to do the same for the town of his birth. He's returning to Anvil not only to take up the mantle of his father as the town's holy man, as it were, but also to try to, you know, shepherd in the salvation of the town that hasn't gone down as dark a path as he has, but it has lost its identity, especially spiritually. And, you know, as your emerging angel, or your would-be angel, Jesse Custer needs a demon antagonist. And in that, you have the brilliantly portrayed by Jackie Earle Haley, Odin Kincaid, of Kincaid Meat and Power.
So good. Just
as the best, as the absolute best little Texas weasel voice I ever heard portrayed
And you're a lifelong Texan, and he has a better Texas accent than half the people that you meet in Texas.
One of the things, as someone who was born and raised in Texas, I actually, Anvil, Texas felt more like Texas than Dallas, Texas felt than Dallas in the 80s,
sure.
Which I hated. Because everybody was like, where's your cowboy hat? Well, we don't actually all wear cowboy hats, honestly.
But Anvil, you get the idea that they have cowboy hats for super special occasions in the top of the closet that they don't break out in case they absolutely need them. So good.
The combination of so many just exaggerated tropes. And then there is this sort of underlying surreal nature, like, you know, the church that Jesse's trying to revive is this antiquated, tiny little speck on a vast acreage of dead scrubland.
Yes, yes.
It's like the single most depressing icon of faith and religion you could imagine. And then you have, and of course, you know, the other surreal qualities are a beautifully subtle nod to modern American sensibilities. They don't shove it down your throat. They don't make it painfully obvious. They don't give you a whole lot of backstory, but you can tell that they're Native American themed high school sport mascot has been PC'd out of existence and replaced with a forest animal.
Yes, yes.
And there's this brilliant, deadly rivalry between the two that acts kind of an analog to the rivalry between Odin Kincannon and Jesse Custer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Jesse has come in and upset the natural order. And you see a lot of that underscored with, you know, his obsessive completion of his accurate Battle of the Alamo, proving that there was a Battle of the Alamo. That's how we got Oklahoma. Ha!
Just everything about Odin Kincannon is perfect. Like,
it's just this exaggerated Texan without being offensive to me. And because then, it's away with it because of the surreal quality and Jackie Earle Haley, who I could not stand in my childhood, in his own childhood, when he was the most foul-mouthed and belligerent of the Bad News Bears, or when he was the high school antagonist in My Bodyguard, or... Yeah.
Wow. I don't even know what to say right now.
Jackie Haley had a full head of hair. He had some admirable blonde locks in his youth that were kept perpetually greasy by Hollywood hairdressers in every role he played, but no wonder he lost most of it.
The most surreal thing in this show that features the child, the energy child of an angel and a demon, a vampire, somebody who worships the god of meat, is the fact that when Odin Kincannon decides, because of a bet gone awry, that he is due the land that Jesse Custer's church sits on, and of course, unbeknownst to anybody, Jesse Custer, because of his past, is not only a crack marksman, but just a badass, is that he decides to lay siege Alamo style to this church, up to and including costuming. So, Johnny Reb costuming.
Exactly. The boys in gray were all advancing upon him with the anachronistic addition of a bulldozer.
So good. I'm just like, what? And you know, Jesse is besieged on all sides by so many things, including, and what might be my favorite kind of the most level-headed thinking character in the entire series is this guy that he gets into a bar fight with, who is sort of the pit boss for Odin Kincannon, who, in order to, because Jesse's voice, if you're not familiar with the comic or you're not familiar with the show at this point, Jesse has the ability to enact a power because of this thing that lives inside of him now to get people to obey his commands. So
yeah, essentially this plays upon what I was trying to was struggling with earlier in this part of the show was the as much as we like to imagine that, you know, that a man of faith to, you know, give yourself over to your to a supreme being somehow elevates you beyond even the common man. Yet when confronted with absolute power that is visited upon him by this entity that's apparently been jumping around trying to find a conduit, he struggles with that up to a point, but then is not above using this power whenever possible, often to detrimental effect.
Right, right. And I'm hoping that in season two we get a lot of the Jesse Custer backstory as to why that is. Because there's some real effed up stuff that happens in the comics that we don't know about yet. Like real effed up. Like super. Like if they put this stuff on TV, I will be shocked and also pleasantly surprised. But
like more effed up than what you've already seen so far.
So far. So much more. So much more effed up than okay, so here's the backstory in a nutshell, and you know, this is the elevator pitch for the story, is that, you know, in heaven, during the war of the angels and the demons, which is always raging, an angel fell in love with a demon. They knocked boots and had an offspring. This offspring was called Genesis. It is the combination of their energies. It is kept in heaven under lock and key. It escapes, makes it to Earth, starts bouncing, starts pinballing around from holy man to holy man, trying to find a vessel that's strong enough to support its power, and just blowing through them like so much crate paper until it finds Jesse, who's had a background and a life that is so troublesome that he's had to build such walls within himself that he can control this. So it gets inside of him and becomes symbiotic with his personage. So you've got this power, you've got the most human character in the entire show, who turns out to be an Irish vampire.
yes, indeed.
Which, again, in the comics, the reveal of Tulip, the reveal of Cassidy are so low key because they just go straight to the crazy ass story that you don't have in the TV show. Cassidy fighting off a plane at 30,000 feet full of vampire hunters and then extricating himself from the situation to the tune of gravity and then creating a crater in the ground in which he climbs out of after sucking a cow dry. You have him waking up in the back of Tulip's car as Tulip has a botched robbery attempt, and that's how they meet and end up going to see Jesse. So the show really kind of kicks it up a notch in terms of those introductions.
And the casting, of course, is absolutely brilliant. Ruth Negga takes a character that could be, speaking of paper thin, as far as just, you know, breathes so much life into the character of Tulip.
Oh, so much.
Because she could have been very two-dimensional under anyone else, almost. And, you know, this wonderful dynamic where, you know, she's very self-absorbed and very possessed of this mission that she's on, and the constant false starts where she's, you know, at once she's perfectly capable, but she feels like she needs Jesse in on this, and he almost becomes the obsession. Cassie is just along for the ride. He's finally found some kindred spirits, and you know, and she winds up getting roped in on his story in a sense.
Just God,
having
Cassie
to be something of an unwitting caregiver.
God, Cassidy is so so brilliantly portrayed, and there's a line in it, and you know, and we're not going to go, you know, episode by episode, though I could and I would love to.
Oh yeah.
There's a
I
line.
I had to rein us in a bit with this.
Yeah. So when Jesse really goes off the reservation and decides he's going to convert the entire town to God's word with his voice, and there's during the time there's a character in the comics that's a little different than the character in the show, and that character is Assface or Arseface.
Arseface, yeah.
He's called that because of a failed suicide attempt. Now in the comics it was because there was a suicide pact between him and his friend that when Kurt Cobain killed himself they were going to kill themselves, and his friend managed to do it and he didn't, left himself horribly scarred with a face that looks kind of like
pretty
butt,
much like an anus,
like a butthole. Yeah, he's got a butthole for a face, and
And of course, Cassidy, being Irish, coins the arse face. That's where
right.
It becomes the sobriquet for the character from then on out.
And in the show, I'm not going to give it away, but it's a lot darker than that. As to why, you know, as to how he gets himself into the condition.
As if you could get darker, they found the way.
Yeah, they went for it. But at one point, not to give too much away, but Jesse does something to Arseface, and Cassidy calls him out on it. Jesse leaves. Cassidy walks outside, and much in vampire fashion, catches on fire because he's in the sun, and you're left to assume that Jesse just leaves him there to die, being so possessed of his new mission and his symbiosis with this Genesis that he leaves him to die. Later you find out he doesn't, and that's one of my favorite lines of the entire show, is Cassidy just in a malformed state because he's been burnt to a crisp but still alive, sitting in front of Jesse after Jesse kind of comes to his senses, and Cassidy saying, "You put me out." And Jesse says, "Not long enough." He's like, "No, but you put me out." Like, that was the humanization. Like, that's enough. Like, I'm a vampire and you saved me. So cool. Now, one of the things I did want to talk about is two characters that were completely different in the TV show than in the book, and that made them my favorite characters in the TV show. In the book, I wasn't such a big fan. In the TV show, absolutely 110%. My favorite thing about the TV show, and that was Fjord and DeBlanc.
Oh, dear Lord.
So
they have this wonderful place within the narrative of being a very serious part of advancing the story and simultaneously being the comic foils.
Right, right.
Because when they run afoul of Jesse, or not Jesse, of Cassidy, rather. Dear God.
Well, and the funny thing, okay, so in the comics, you get a lot more backstory on Genesis and their role in his kind of, and their role as jailers. So Genesis escapes because of their ineptitude. They have to fix it before anyone else, before like the archangels find out, right? So they head to Earth on almost what would be a driven mission to get this thing back. Very little humor, a lot of bumbling, you know, but it wasn't humorous. And in the show, you get this alien fish out of water idea of what human beings are that, God, it's so funny. It's my favorite. Whenever they would pop up, I would laugh so hard, and just it was so surreal.
Even right down to the way the costume design for them, it's like they've got a vague idea of what you're supposed to, you know, wear clothes and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like they where did you find, you can't go buy that sort of thing off the rack. You're just, you know, they're manifesting themselves in a way that makes them almost seem out of place or ridiculous. Like when they're in Africa, they're trying very much to look the part.
Yes, yes.
And then they doff that in favor of trying to look very Western.
Well, and they become, without knowing what it is to be human, they become more human than anyone else in the show, where, for instance, they're watching the commercials for whatever the big, what was it, the big Texan burger or the big American burger?
Oh, yeah, something like, yeah.
And he goes to the hotel front desk and demands a big American burger. And he's like, "We don't have a restaurant here. We got a vending machine."
and it does sort of paint them as, like you say, the fish out of water. They're from, none of this world makes sense to them.
Right, right.
But they have to be here for the duration of their mission. And then, of course, you have one of the most brilliant scenes, I think, in much the same way. I absolutely love the scene with, was it, it's not Ravel's Bolero that was playing in Legion, was it? Where he's trying to move the bullets.
Oh, Jermaine Clement, is that who you're looking for?
Yeah, the actual music, the classical music.
Oh, I think it was Bolero. I think it was Bolero.
Okay, yeah, I kept talking myself in and out of Bolero, but yeah, I do believe it may have been Ravel's Bolero. In much the same way, that just made a scene. This was one of these things where it became like Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days on Monty Python, was the damn scene where they're fighting the other angel, and each time one of them is mortally wounded. they're instantaneously returned to this plane of existence, but their mortal remains are still there.
Right, right.
To the point where it's just this savage bloodbath. It looks like a Frank Frazetta Conan prep standing atop a mountain of dead and mangled bodies and disembowelments and such that, you know, that ultimately their only solution is to just incapacitate their adversary, yet leave her in a state where she can't quite be allowed to die.
Right, right. It's nuts. What was the most shocking thing in Preacher for you?
Well, I think, I don't know if it quite is shocking so much as brilliant in its delivery. And because both of these shows had elements that came very close to, dangerously close to being tedious.
Yeah.
Got away with it because they didn't quite hit tedious. It was like, you know, the needle was going over into the red and all of a sudden, oh, we're okay. And in this one, the scene with the Kincannon family in Sweden or somewhere on this sky tram going up the mountainside that malfunctions and ultimately falls, you know, the cable snaps and they fall to their death. And that whole scene leading up, you know, presenting that moment in Odin Kincannon's past, it just borders on becoming tenuous when the cable snaps, and then you get the reveal where, you know, I think it was his right-hand man walks in on him in his vastly office there, and on one, and there's these crates containing just the massive organs and bits and pieces that remain of his family, and a dead cow, a freshly slaughtered cow, over the floor, and he's just piles of entrails in both hands, and this is the moment where he has completely snapped. His entire world is gone, and he's there trying to fathom the difference. And you get this implicit idea that it became kind of a personal shell game, to the point where what's in his right hand and what's in his left hand, being cognitive of which was which, is long since passed.
Yeah.
And that way you can eventually trick yourself into forgetting which nut has the which shell has the pea under it.
Yeah.
If you play around with it long enough and allow your attention to drift. And so he's just handfuls of intestine, and he can't make a distinction between human and cat and bovine. And to me, that was also the point where you do get the reveal that when he's serving God, and especially when he's just at the end of his rope, as is everyone in Anvil, apparently, some at the end of a rope. That he has. I look at that as the point where his faith converted from God to the God of meat. If he ever even.
Oh my God, the God of meat. God. Jesus, just the God of meat. Damn it.
In many ways, I think that first scene you get with him where he's just kind of got the PA system hooked up to the abattoir so he can listen to the cattle being slaughtered and as a kind of white noise.
Well, and I mean, the whole spin out of that whole scene is the fact that, you know, Jesse needs the town on his side. So yeah. What he does is he goes to Odin Kincannon and says, I'll make a deal with you. If you come to my church on Sunday and you don't leave believing in God, then I will give you my church. So he comes to church and Jesse ends up using his power on him to make him admit and say vocally and publicly that he believes in God. So therefore the town sort of...
Yeah, he will serve God.
He will serve God. And the town sort of all falls in line at that point because the biggest atheist, the biggest, you know, anti-God, you know, character in their universe just turned. Well, then the turnout later is he demands the church. Jesse says, no, you told me you believe you serve God. And then Cole, what happens?
The big reveal is that he serves God, but he serves the God of meat.
The God of meat! The goddamn God of meat, ladies and gentlemen.
This is also what's so brilliant is the wonderfully surreal concept of Kincannon meat and power. that the Kincannon family have been like sort of the slaughterhouse, the meat processing moguls,
yeah,
of this corner of Texas, and presumably also ranchers, because then they take all the effluents and run the entire town of Anvil on a methane-based energy.
Yes.
System. So, you know, take that, International Geophysical Year. So, and of course that becomes an important part of the plot there toward the end anyway, but that, you know, he is so fallen, you know, that I guess in his mind, I think when confronted with the inescapable necessity of serving God, his mind served the only God it could recognize, and that was the God of meat, because meat was the only thing he could count on after he'd snapped.
Right, right.
That, you know, the heroes of the Alamo, of course, like any good Texan.
But that was a crazy reveal. Like there were two things.
The other crazy thing was that model had a basement.
Nothing in Texas has a basement. The Alamo doesn't have a basement.
There's no basement in the Alamo.
There's no basement in the Alamo. No, so that was your big one. My big one was, and there are two instances in the show, and I think we're going to have to wrap it up shortly after this, but nothing is sacred, no pun intended, nothing is sacred in this show, and all bets are off.
That's so true.
And there's a lot of things that I really hope that they bring into the next season that weren't in this season, that were in the comic, that are even crazier. But the one thing that got me, I think, the most was, so there's a character in the show called, by the name of Emily Woodrow. Emily Woodrow is Jesse's right-hand helper at the church. She handles all of the, you know, getting the wine and the, you know, getting the blood of Christ and the body of Christ together, printing flyers, you know, getting everything together.
I think she is ultimately the one character who is the biggest believer in Jesse himself.
But the thing is, so she represents normality in this world to the point where she has multiple standoffs with Tulip, which are pretty damn hilarious. Like when Tulip thinks she's messing with her man, and she comes storming in and grabs this arts and crafts dinosaurs that Emily's kids made, and just without a word, just storms into Emily's house and just slams it against the wall. And then leaves and goes, sits in her car, and then Emily comes out and is like, that's real, you know, like that's great, good job, and then leaves, and then Tulip comes back in and offers to, and they have a budding friendship once the realization
exactly.
is there, that, you know, but the one thing that completely, so throughout the entire season, Emily is kind of the backbone, the normalcy in Jesse's life, the normalcy in all of their lives, you know.
She becomes sort of the anchor, and especially because the town itself, even that is so out of step.
Yeah, she has kids that go to soccer practice. She does stuff, you know, she does all the administrative stuff for the church. She's dating the mayor, you know, this milquetoast, no-spine mayor that they have in this town, which which they've portrayed brilliantly. But and again, spoiler heavy, after Cassidy is burnt alive and is in dire straits, they're trying to heal him, and they're giving him all the animals at the pet store, and nothing is seeming to work.
Well, they can't, you know, no one in the surrounding counties will let them buy or adopt any pets, because
the blood from the hospital that they've basically run the hospital out of isn't working. Emily, you know, and you can tell that the relationship with the mayor isn't great, that she's not particularly happy, but it's the normal thing to do, right?
Yeah.
You date the mayor, you have your kids, you know, there are scenes where it's like,
she's got to have that father figure in her life.
Yeah. Up until the point when her friend, Jesse Custer, her friend Cassidy, her friend Tulip, need her help. She makes a panicked call to the mayor. The mayor shows up to help her. She locks him in a room with Cassidy, in which Cassidy destroys him.
I was shocked.
I was taken completely aback at that turn of events. I was like, I literally said out loud, holy shit. Like, because you're not given any indication as to that this is going to transpire, and you get this idea.
Apart from he's annoying to her.
Yes.
And his amorous advances. And,
yes, you know, like, he's the...
But not to the point where, you know, he's... It's not like he's abusive and has it coming.
Which is different, you know, than the entire rest of the men in this town, by the way.
Yeah,
because every one of them, with the exception of the vampire and the guy that's possessed of God and demon juice, is horribly abusive and misogynistic.
Except that he's like, his wife craves his power trip. It's almost like he's become the abusive husband because that's what she needs.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's her fetish, is to be the abused wife, and it's almost an act on his part.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But no, I never expected this turn of events. I never expected this kind of anti-hero turn from Emily to save Cassidy. She'll sacrifice this ineffective mayor. You know, almost a calculation for the greater good at that point was pretty amazing. Like, that was crazy. To me, that was crazy. That was as crazy as the craziest, weirdest, funniest thing in the show to me was the Benny Hill episode-esque killing of the angel clones.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, God, that was hilarious. Heaven sends a warrior angel after the... were they sending them after Fiori and...
Yeah, she was there to bring him to heal.
Right, right. But the problem is, when her corporeal form dies, it's resurrected in another...
Oh, yeah, that was that whole Sam Peckinpah's salad days there in the hotel room.
Oh, my God. And then they figure it out and leave her armless, limbless in a bathtub.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. It was just like, this show is effed up.
Well, then I think the ultimate was this very... The point where, you know, they'd already established the occasional point where they just stepped aside and let something be completely ridiculously surreal.
Yeah.
To the point where it almost took you away from the entire thing. You're like, did they really mean for that to be so cartoony or something? But then by then you're allowing it. It sort of sets the stage for things like the dueling mascots and a lot of other things that happen. And ultimately, when you get the... Jesse actually phoning Heaven,
right,
with the mechanism taken from the angels, the sort of hotline to God, and you get this kind of passion play, Zeus,
yeah,
a manifestation of God. You essentially get the God that appeared in Savage Dragon,
right,
and you're like, okay, this just really got weird. And then it turns out that, like, no, I'm just dressing like this because that's what you expect God to look like.
Exactly,
We don't know what's happening. And this panicked entity, you know, this creature of divinity that's just in a state of panic because no one knows exactly what's become a god.
Yep. And that's that, and you get the idea that that's just the state that Heaven's in between them and Fjord and oh God, why can't I think of his name? Fjord and DeBlanc. You get this idea that nobody knows. The left hand has no idea.
Yes, right, exactly. Doing there's so much, and then they're trying to book passage to hell.
Oh, God, that was so funny.
But they can't stop Jesse on their own, so they're going to go find. And then we talked before the show, unfortunately, we're running so low of time, but the beleaguered gunfighter that, again, this is one of those points where it comes short of monotony, but there's such a brilliant reveal.
Yes, yeah. The in the comics, you come to know him as the Saint of Killers. He's the ultimate assassin, unstoppable, and you get the brilliant backstory, which they weave through this season. In the comics, he has his own standalone four-issue story arc, the Saint of Killer. That's how you get his background. In this, they weave it brilliantly in little vignettes through the beginnings of these episodes, and it's so good. It's so good. I can't stress enough how brilliant both of these shows are, and if you are suffering from comic book show fatigue, fall back on these, and they are a breath of crazy, insane,
yes,
fresh air.
literally the theater of the mind, because both of these are such psychological masterpieces.
Well, speaking of psychological masterpieces,
I can't wait to see the second season of both.
Oh, man. We'll do another show, because there's some things I really hope are coming in both of the shows in the second seasons. So speaking of psychological masterpieces, Cole and Eddie are on a summer tour that I'm sure that we want to talk about all the dates coming up for that, so that you guys can get in line.
Oh yeah, in fact, as you're listening, it's depending on when it drops during the day on Friday. That evening, Eddie and I will be taking the stage at Famous Monsters in our second stop on the Rancor Pit Roadshow Summer Invasion Tour 2017. Only our second stop of seven stops between May and August. This is our most ambitious anything ever.
As liked by Adam Carolla on Instagram.
Yes, apparently a couple of Instagram grams.
Posts. We'll call them posts. I think they're posts.
It just seemed rather droll in an era where everything had its own special name for what you do there.
Yes.
But yeah, Eddie would make a couple of posts of stuff about the famous monsters. The first one actually had a hashtag of famous monsters and stuff, but the later ones didn't. And both Adam Carolla and his producer liked the first one. They both wound up liking some of the other ones. And I was like, we're like being noticed by Adam Carolla. The famous monsters, the folks there at Famous Monsters, I think the Rancor Pit and the Rancor Pit Live have been put in front of probably five times the audience that ever was aware of us before.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because if you go to their website, and if you're listening to this show, ideally it's because you've, you know, fell down the rabbit hole that is the Jedi Cult universe. Perhaps, but if you get a chance, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the Rancor Pit will be at booth A101 in the Artist Alley, and once a day we will be taking the stage on Friday for the Rancor Pit Roadshow Do It Yourself, where we've already confired representatives of the Mandalorian Mercs. And ideally, we'll have somebody there from the R2 builders, from the Astromech builders as well, talking about the just amazing, the evolution of Star Wars costuming that's handmade solo.
I had to do it.
Fabrications of droids and things like that, and even the cottage industry, people who fabricate suits of armor and parts and what have you, machine pieces for people to build their own droids with, because you can't just go to Hobby Lobby and get all the component parts. And Saturday we have the Galactic Games 5, the Rancor Pit's signature game show, twice produced on the live show, twice produced live with the at conventions, and now for the for your pleasure at Famous Monsters, you can check us out on the stage there. And then on Sunday we're taking a little bit of a departure from the Star Wars. A panel I was really thrilled about. Eddie was just immediately behind it. In honor of Forrest J. Ackerman and Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, Favorite Monsters of Filmland is our theme. And Eddie and I are going to talk about our favorite movie monsters from back, what I call the era when a horror movie was about monsters, not murderers.
There you go. I love it. So if anybody wants to hear or see the Rancor Pit, where can they go to brush up to the crib notes coming up on Famous Monsters?
Yeah, well, check us out on the Jedi Cult universe, JediCult.com. We're starting to get our steam back behind us on the recorded show, the Rancor Pit. We are publishing 4 episodes in the month of May in celebration of the 40th anniversary of Star Wars, the last which will drop, I believe, on the 23rd or the 26th. I'm sad that I'm having to balk on this at the moment, but I've just been talking about some crazy-ass TV shows.
Yeah, you can't think about anything right now. Don't even try.
Yeah, but basically we're taking you right up to the actual day of the 40th anniversary of Star Wars. 4 different episodes, decades, 40 years of Star Wars. The first 2 episodes are already up on the site. Third episode I hope to have up before Famous Monsters, if we can squeeze that in. Basically, we're taking from the premiere date through 1 year later, or 1 year later, 10 years later. We just completed part 2, Before the Dark Times. Right up to the cusp of episodes 1 through 3.
Favorite Star Wars movies. What? They are what?
I'm sorry. I thought you were like gonna say your favorite Star Wars movies.
Listen, I like to have Pokemon seizures when I'm watching anything that's metallic land on a planet. That's a thing for me. It's sexual. We don't like to talk about it a lot. It's a thing that I enjoy.
Well, you know, you're younger and you get away with it.
I'm younger. You're an ass.
If you're keen on conventions like Famous Monsters, which is of course going to be 26th to the 28th, I believe, if I'm not missing my dates there. Yeah, the 26th to the 28th of May in Dallas, Texas at the Sheraton downtown. Amazing, $65 for a 3-day pass.
That's insane. That is an insane price.
It's a huge show, and there's stuff going on all day long. It's not just a bunch of autograph guests in a dealer room. They're screening movies and stuff. Eddie and Andy both have been gushing over all the movies that they're playing during the course of this weekend.
I'm insanely jealous of the movies that
they're playing. They're screening Valley of Guanji, for God's sake.
Right?
I'm going to sneak away and go see my favorite cowboy and dinosaur movie ever. Well, it's the only one. check out Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. Still your go-to source for conventions in the state of Texas. I'm very happy that other people have taken up the torch, as it were, and tried to get on their Facebook pages or other places some decent listings, but I remain consistently the resource for every convention in the state of Texas. If I'm aware of it, it makes it on the site. A few of them still fall through the cracks, but that's on them, not me. I started this site because all of them used to fall between the cracks.
Right. So it's a huge, valuable resource. It's
attendees, for convention promoters, for artists, for vendors to just figure out what's out there. With over 100 conventions a year in the state of Texas in the last 3 years, keep it 100, Texas. We now have the Rancor Pit has its own committed email address, therantcorpit@gmail.com. Hey Kids will soon have its own. I just haven't got around to that yet, but for now you can write to jcumail@yahoo.com. But I figure by giving committed things, I won't put anything else there, and I can actually not miss anybody's mail.
There you go.
And the Jolly Cool Universe Ranker Pit and Hey Kids Comics all have Facebook pages. You can I've got a personal Instagram now under Cole Houston, or Jedi Cole, I can't recall which. I'm starting to actually utilize now. The Rancor Pit has an Instagram, and I really need to do the same for Hey Kids. So we're going to be doing a whole lot of coverage. We're going to do some Facebook Live stuff for the Rancor Pit out at Famous Monsters. The next live show a week from Sunday, the 28th, so a week from the 20th, first Sunday in June. Rancor Pit Live is going to be titled Here There Be Monsters. We'll have a ton of coverage from Famous Monsters because we're doing so much there. I can't say enough good about that show. The folks at Famous Monsters have just been dynamite promoting us as we promote them. And
Lastly, if you like what you hear,
I'm not sure it's real.
It's real. You guys deserve it. You guys bust your ass. You guys absolutely deserve what you're getting. But lastly, if you guys like what you hear from us, from Rantcore, from anything, head over to iTunes, rate and review the shows on iTunes, push us up the lists. That's what's going to get us recognition. That's what's going to get Cole and Eddie more shows, and possibly Hey Kids Comics more shows in the future. We got to wrap it up. So buy, collect, enjoy, watch.
Tell Adam Carolla how much you love the Jedi Cole Universe.
Yeah, please do. Please do. But yeah, buy, collect, enjoy, watch, and melt your mind with these shows. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody. We're going to be back next week with, I believe we're starting a new story arc, which is a rather timely story.
And we're going to have some rather timely guests as well. It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. So what I would suggest you do is... burn some incense, listen to some Pink Floyd, then listen to some Johnny Cash, then listen to some Loretta Lynn, then listen to some Rolling Stones, watch Legion, watch Preacher, enjoy yourself, and get yourself a Zippo that says fuck communism, even though they didn't include that in the show. All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Incense, peppermints.